Welcome back to We Need Ice, Explosion on the Railroad. It's been a minute since the last episode launch, and I've come to understand that's just how some podcasts go. We Need Ice is a true storytelling style of delivery, so episodes 1 through 7 go through the real-life events of July 5th, 1973, when a blevy ravaged the small town of Kingman, Arizona, killing 12 and injuring, burning hundreds of innocent men, women, and children. The bonus episodes, like this one, are spawned from witnesses, scholars, and industry professionals reaching out to add to this project with their experiences. These bonus episodes are just as informative and captivating has been the description I hear most from listener feedback. So make sure you follow, like, and subscribe to this show. You never know when I'll be back with more. In this episode, I collaborate with the Volunteer Firefighter Podcast hosts to discuss their responsibilities as active volunteer firemen and how their volunteerism gives them a connection to the 73 Kingman Blevy. The guys get into it with me about courage, fear, PTSD, and some of the most memorable calls they've responded to, including a potential Blevy situation. How did they handle that? You're about to find out in part one of this two-parter episode. And if you're a returning listener of the We Need Ice podcast, you know every episode has begun with a rather explicit disclaimer. I'm going to skip that today so we can jump into the interview with the guys, but just know, we're still talking around a heavy topic. Make sure to visit weneedice.com for more info, resources, images, articles, etc. around the amazing true story of the 1973 Blevy in Kingman, Arizona. Let's get into it.
Guys, we're here with Meg Moran from the We Need Ice podcast. It's a 10-part series. You got some bonus episodes that came out there on the backside as well. Meg, hello. Thanks for coming on. And tell us quickly a bit about yourself. And then on the backside of that, maybe quickly dive in and tell us what made you want to start the podcast.
Of course. Thank you guys so much for talking with me today. The We Need Ice podcast, as the story is, it's more like the first 7 episodes. And then once the podcast launched, there were some witnesses, as I had anticipated, people kind of coming out of the woodwork. No one really knows if you're going to tell their intimate story well or respectfully, you know, or in a light that that they want to be a part of. So that's where the bonus episodes came out of, and that's what this will be. And I'm so grateful for that, because as we kind of talked about prior to the call, it's not something that I was even around for, like living when this event happened in Kingman, Arizona, 1973. It was something that I just fell in love with, a story that I fell in love with, because a dear, dear friend of mine was a resident when the Blevy happened on July 5th, 1973. And she slowly started opening up her memories to me. And then, as luck would have it, she kept telling me she had all these newspapers from the Kingman Miner, that she had saved them all. Her husband was a volunteer firefighter. On that day, he got the call, like they would all somehow get this CB radio call, or even the broadcast radio would kind of alert them if there was an incident. He was working in the mines, which was like 30 minutes away. So he got the call and he's traveling back to, of course, put his life in danger to help his community when this was going on. By the time he got there, he was just dealing with carnage and the explosion had happened. So his life was spared then. But she ended up finding these newspapers kind of at some point when, you know, I would go, we would take a walk or, you know, meet for appetizers, and she would start telling me. And I was so captivated. And I told her one day that I figured I'd go home and find like a documentary or something I could read or watch. And there wasn't much out there. So I asked her if she didn't mind telling me more about it and would trust me to do something with it. And at the time, I had no idea. Is it a blog or just a story, or I'm just preserving it for her and her children and her grandchildren? And it was no small feat to get her on my side on this. But as the project kind of enhanced and I told her my ideas and started sharing with her what could be done and why it would be done, I think we finally came to an understanding and an agreement of where to head. And yes, she decided it was therapeutic to talk about it after all these years. So that kind of explains my connection or why I've grown so fondly to telling the story. You know, having the power to do that for somebody is something not to take lightly, but I did want to kind of wield it that, like, this is something to do because I felt like it hadn't been done before.
Yeah, I think like what you just said there, you know, really resonates with us. And that's sort of the background of why we started to do what we do here at the Volunteer Firefighter Podcast. So obviously we are three volunteer firefighters. We've been in the service for a variety of years. Todd, a few more than Scott. Scott and I and literally everybody else living. Todd's been in the service for quite a few years. He's also a paramedic, as is his quote, Monday to Friday job. We all know that's not what they are. But so like we all have that volunteerism background, obviously firefighting. And we do the podcast. So because there's not a lot of information period out there. There's not a lot of things that are geared towards the volunteerism of it. And the, like you just said there, the therapy of it, of, you know, sitting down and like we kind of talk about bumper talk. So like when you get back to the fire station after a more difficult call, that is really like our therapy. So when we can sit down and not debrief in a like a serious manner, in a like a black and white manner, you can sit there and just chat amongst your friends and your colleagues, that's where the main therapy is. And like just hearing that from you about your friend, like once she started to open up and start telling the story, start reliving the story, like through her husband and then through you, going back all those years to 1973, I'm sure that was a big healing process that maybe she didn't even know that she needed.
I think so. And even still, she's the podcast after launch got a little bit of traction with the Kingman, Arizona. Kingman, Arizona is still a small town, although of course it's grown. So it was in the newspaper, and I know that's where at launch a lot of listeners were gained. And of course, we were both so grateful for that. But it was like hitting her like a Mack truck all over again, like, oh my gosh, people are gonna, she doesn't want to tell her story that is inaccurate in anyone else's head. So it's a constant reminder to tell her that this is what you experienced. And at the beginning, because she was so fearful or kind of worried about this concept of she didn't want to paint seagulls in anyone's painting, everything she said, I would look it up, you know, and although the resources were slim, the facts are there. And I tell you, this 82-year-old woman has not been wrong about anything yet. So the trust was built really, really quickly. And of course, that helped.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the husband of the woman you're talking about, he went to the scene knowing what was happening, I guess. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he probably didn't have like direct radio access like we do currently in like today's society. Like we can hear everything that's going on in the fire ground when we're driving to a scene. But this whole kind of what resonates with me is the fact that this reminds me of a lot of an incident we had a couple of years ago, where actually Ash and I were driving to a structure fire because we were a ways away from it.
Yeah.
And we were driving to it, and it was actually a propane boat. It was a pretty big one, like 1,000-pound propane cylinder.
Yeah.
It was cooking off when we got there. All the other guys were there fighting the fire. Mm-hmm. And the jet engine noise it was making was like, cause it had already started venting. Mm-hmm. And I remember some people, cause we were staging quite a ways away, but then the trucks were, we were pretty close with the trucks trying to cool it. And I remember some people said to us, like, what are you guys doing? Why are you guys going in there? We're like, well, that's what we have to do.
Yeah.
So it was actually, to me, it was just another day in the fire service. To them, it was like, oh my God, what are you guys doing?
Right.
And that, it obviously never blevied on us, but it was probably the closest I've seen to a blevy
potential.
Yeah. We ended up cooling the tank and stopping the blevy from possibly happening. But yeah, it was like, to us, it was just another day. To them, it was like, my God, what are you guys doing?
Scott, yeah. That's something I've heard from witness after witness, whether it's the actual explosion of the blevy or prior to the hissing. It's very eerie. So you guys were obviously up close, quite personal. And yeah, no wonder people were like, what the hell are you doing over there? Get away. And this is maybe a good point to reference, because a lot of my research back then, they were just learning about this unmanned monitor strategy. Does that ring a bell with you guys?
So the unmanned monitor down in the ground, like we have one in our hall, it doesn't get utilized too often. We actually had a quite a big event, whatever, 15 years ago,
yeah,
give or take. Our high school burnt down. It was a massive event here. And I mean, at that point, when it's that involved, you're only protecting the exposures. And that's when these large monitors come out. Something like this with a blevy, that's when these large water monitors would be coming out. In today's day, you have more often like engine or apparatus mounted monitors that are actually attached directly to the fire truck that you can operate from a safe distance and then lob and project water, you know, again, from a very safe distance, or a lot safer than having to go and extend hose lines in and put yourself a lot closer to that harm.
To prevent a blevy, an explosion. And in 73, I know for sure time was not on their side. It happened very, very quickly. And, you know, maybe a little bit of not having the proper equipment and procedures in place at that time, because so much has changed since then. And because of this event, they were a little ill-equipped, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, looking back in 1973 versus today's standards, we were actually, so we just did a podcast last night and we were chatting on the one that we recorded about what prompts change in the fire service.
Or
basically anything. Yeah. I mean, we kind of branched out to anything in the world. And it's generally when there's a fatality or a larger number of, people pass, injuries or, there's death or something tragic generally happens in a larger scale. And that's what prompts change. So as much as like was kind of mentioned on the onset of our chat here, not a lot of people knew about Kingman and what happened there. But I think after hearing your podcast, going back and doing our own research on it as well, tying everything in, like we can see things today that are, I think, directly related to that very day, and then all of the research and everything else that happened after that. So with that day spurring a lot of what we see in today's society in the fire service, they obviously didn't have that, because it wasn't they didn't have any large scale event to learn from. So they were going in there doing whatever their base level of training taught them, which at that time I'm sure was great. But in today's day and in today's standard was, I'm sure, like you said, very much behind the ball on time, and then very much, lacking on not the training, just the overall knowledge, because it hadn't happened yet.
Right. In one of the episodes, I say something very similar to what you just said. And it's like, if necessity is the mother of invention, then mass casualties are the catalyst of reinvention. Right. So yeah, as you were kind of saying, like it does, unfortunately, but how else are you going to know that your procedure isn't working? 9/11 is a great example. And I kind of referenced that in the podcast. I remember when you could show up, running late to the airport and just like fly right through, and you can leave stuff in your pocket and they just wave you in, and you've got a full size shampoo in your carry on, no big deal. But yeah, those days are long gone and never coming back, but we all remember. I'm showing my age.
Yeah. Us as well.
Well, and I think also the safety improvements of the cylinders are greater nowadays too. Like that propane cylinder that we were dealing with, it had its safety valve was working well. So I think those are also improved obviously over time, not just our tactics, but this general safety of everything.
Yeah. All the containers and the way the pressure vessels are designed now, right? It's a lot safer for us to handle. And part of that scream, that high pitched whistle you hear, it is because it's doing what it's supposed to. It's bleeding that pressure off.
Sure.
And then that's that eerie scream, which we've all heard.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, again, the timing, which you referred to, Meg, is that they had time against them. Just that superheated flame front they're facing, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And it's interesting, too, because like the training is you don't actually, like when it's venting like that, we actually don't want to put the flame out. We want to just cool the cylinder so it cools that blowing liquid. We want it to kind of cook itself off to get rid of that, get rid of the fuel. Because what's happened in the past is you put the flame out and now you have all this like gas, propane leaking out. And now it creates pockets of explosive gas where you can't see it. And all of a sudden it touches off again. And you get a
secondary explosion.
Yeah.
It's not directly,
related to the bloody, it's just a different explosion. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing with the new technology from these events.
Yeah,
with these ground monitors now and the master streams that we deal with, the pure gallons per minute that we have now with those, and we can suppress, like you said, Scott, the flame just enough where it's not out, but it's still burning. But we're controlling that intensity to cool that cylinder down.
I would suspect probably in Kingman though, even. Now I'm wondering how many hydrants and such they have, just because that's obviously those master streams take a lot of water,
huge volume.
So yeah. One thing we were dealing with is on this propane cylinder we had was we were out in a bit of a farm field, so we were running water tenders, so basically water trucks, essentially as fast as we could. But those master streams go through hundreds of gallons a minute, so you can run out pretty quick. So you kind of have to really watch what you're doing.
For sure.
Monitor.
Yeah, when you're pushing 750 gallons per minute and you have 1,000 gallons on one truck, you're running out pretty quick.
So how long on this incident did it take you guys to cool down this cylinder full of propane? And this was what, this week or last week?
Oh, no, this was...
A couple of years ago. That incident, we're reaching back a couple of years now. Probably 2 or 3.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't that long. I mean, in the incident, everything always feels like it's definitely taking longer than it should or than you would like. But I would say within 5 minutes of actual direct cooling, it was to a safe space.
Because the idea is it was getting impinged on by the structure fire that was burning next to it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of doing double duty. You're trying to cool the cylinder, but you're also trying to knock down the fire, which is making the cylinder hot.
Right.
So it was kind of like we're sharing water, like we're putting water on the fire, trying to knock it down, and then also water on the cylinder to keep it cool. So once the fire is knocked down from the structure, then the cylinder is going to cool on its own.
That's right.
But if we only concentrate on the structure, the cylinder is heating up. So it's like you kind of have to like know where you're putting your water, and then understanding you're going to be low on water soon. So you have to really put water on the cylinder while the trucks are still coming with water. It's kind of touchy.
Back and forth.
Yeah, a little back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys recall the atmospheric temperature or just the temperature, the weather? Like
It was September, because I remember it was the first day of hunting season.
Which is why we were coming a little bit delayed.
Yeah. it's like September 1st here. And it was a warm day because we were kind of
hurrying. Unseasonably warm.
Yeah, it was like probably 21 degrees Celsius. So I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit.
I don't know what it is in Fahrenheit. I should have pulled up a converter.
I guess it'd be about 768, because room temperature is 21 degrees here. So,
yeah, you're 68. Just shy of 70. Yeah.
And just for reference on this in 1973, so this tanker had been sitting there for about a month in the desert. And on this day, it was like 108 degrees Fahrenheit, of course.
So
that would be considerably, I mean, you're almost talking 40 degrees hotter than it was on that day. So it maybe makes a little more, it makes sense to me just hearing you guys. You were like, it probably took about 5, you know, minutes, give or take. By the time these guys had gotten to it, it had been burning for 8 minutes prior to the explosion. There was like a mini explosion on top of the rail car where the gas had been leaking. They tried to fix it and it caused an explosion, which injured one guy and fatally injured or killed the other guy that was working on it. That's why all these firefighters and mostly volunteer firefighters were there to address that situation and try to cool down the tank. So they were very aware of what could happen, but it was just like, this is what they're trained to do. You run into the fire basically. And that's something that's just hella admirable about what you guys are doing as volunteers.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's, you know, it's, you know, one of those things that, you know, firefighters, every first responder for the most part doesn't, you know, like we don't like to think of it like, oh yeah, we're running in when others are running out. There's, you know, the people that wear the t-shirt and want to go and do that. Where we're, you know, we're not that. I think most people in the service aren't that. We're just, you train hard, you get the experience. You have these, you know, live event, you know, fire experiences. And you don't think, it's more of a reaction. You're thinking about your, you know, safety, your team safety, things like that. That's what your brain is trying to process. And you're falling back on that training. And I'm sure back in 1973, those firefighters, those police officers, everybody that was responding to the event, they were just falling back on their training, falling back on knowing this is what they need to do. And like, they weren't thinking anything else. They weren't thinking about the fear. They weren't thinking about anything else. They're just going to react and they're going to run in and do what they can do. Because like we've said a bunch of times, like we're it. If we don't go, no one's going. So
yeah, there's not some professional league that shows up to help you.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So when those tones drop, when these calls come in, when they got, you know, the radio message, or when they were getting the message over CB, whatever it was back in Kingman. They all started racing either directly to the event or over to the fire station, and they were reacting and they were going to run in there and do what they have trained to do. And, you know, it's admirable what, like on the back end of, you know, the first explosion, the second explosion. And yeah, it was very, very tragic, but I mean, there was a lot of amazing work that did happen that day. It's a shame to see negative side of it, obviously, but there was a lot of amazing work that happened from a small community back in 73.
Absolutely. And I think everyone that I speak to, that's a big, big thing or motto or overlapping theory and blanket that they want to put out there, that even the unlikely of people rose to the occasion. And I'm actually quoting somebody that lived there that talked to me, Teresa Roundsville. She's looking into writing she has written a screenplay about this. And we got connected through a current firefighter that's in Kingman active right now. And she said that even, you know, these everyday Joes or these average Joes, everyday people in a small community, when faced with something like this, they rise to the occasion, and it's the most unlikely of heroes. And she said something to the effect of, a lot of limelight has been on the firefighters. And then a couple episodes after the final one, I talked to a former police officer, and he really opened my eyes to what they stepped in and did, because there is so much lauding the firefighters. But Teresa was saying that she really felt like it was these everyday guys and the volunteers that really stepped in and saved a lot of the firefighters on that day. So again, there's no, you're never going to get any lack of appreciation on this end. You guys are doing something that so many people aren't doing. And I think you just said that, like, there's no like force that comes in like SWAT team firefighters to handle these types of situations. It's because you guys are there in the community and you've volunteered your time. How much of your time is committed to this? Do you have regular 9-to-5s?
Yeah. So everybody sitting here, everybody on our department, in Oliver, British Columbia, where we're from, we are all pure pig on call. So like we still classify ourselves as a volunteer department. We do get paid per call, but we do have, like all of us do carry that quote nine to five, Monday to Friday. And the only difference between our area and Todd's is they have
basically admin staff.
Yeah, they have some administration staff that's paid, but all of the active firefighting is done same thing as a paid on call.
That's right.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so I guess what your question was, so we have 9 to 5, and then with the firefighting stuff, we do like we practice Thursdays, Todd practice Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. So every week we do two and a half hours.
2 to 2.5 hours.
Depending on what we're doing. But and that varies too.
Yeah, it doesn't really end there either. Yeah, because again, with the kind of the volunteerism that we have, you know, the way the halls are run, you know, when you start designing a new truck or you get new pieces of equipment for that truck, it's us who are researching, purchasing, you know, placing it on the truck, organizing training, getting everybody out there doing the training evolutions, you know, setting up scenarios for the weekends and for that next training night, right?
And then the calls.
Yeah, and then the calls, of course. But that's unchecked, right? That's just kind of what you do.
Yeah, so back to saying that we are paid on call. Yeah, like when an event happens, you know, whatever it might be, you know, motor vehicle accident, structure fire, wildland, forest or grass fire, medical, things along those lines, that's when we are getting paid. But like all of the time that we spend, you know, getting all of our training nights prepped, getting like we in Oliver here have an amazing training facility right down the street from our department where we have 3 live fire buildings that we can go and do actual live burn events and train. So we're down there prepping, we're down there cleaning. There's a large group of people that help out with that. And that's all free. That's just us wanting to better our skill. So there is some unlimited funds, but still there's so much of it on, you know, the outside looking in to make everything work that is for free, and we're just happy to do it because we want to, you know, continue to invest time in our skill set.
Right, that's quite a commitment.
Well, I don't know about you, but I sure hope there are some guys like these around if, God forbid, I'm ever in a bad spot. Check out DTFF, the Volunteer Firefighter Podcast, and head over to weneedice.com. Hit that subscribe button and I'll let you know when part 2 and future episodes are released. Till next time.